Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi everyone, the next couple of weeks will mark kind of a new departure for Sentimental Garbage that I'm really excited to tell you about. So usually on the podcast I speak to people about the culture that they love that they feel has been unfairly dismissed, but I'm also really interested in talking to the artists who created that work. I wanted to start with a scene that I find particularly fascinating, which is the early noughties indie twee era. This is the movement that brought us tote bags and ukuleles and arguably adult colouring books. It also brought us the Juno soundtrack and Zooey Deschanel and dressing like a 1950s secretary with a leather satchel. But despite how massive indie twee was, there's actually not that much about it from the people who were actually there. And now that it's having kind of a TikTok revival, I'm really interested in getting into the guts of the whole thing. So for the next two episodes, I'm going to be investigating tweeness in all its forms, talking to two creators. The first is Joff Owen from The Boy Least Likely 2, and the second is Rebecca Taylor, aka Self Esteem, formerly of the band Slow Club, which were kind of one of the last great gasps of indie pop twee music. I hope you enjoy these episodes because I loved making them and hope I get to do a little bit more of this in the future. Okay, thanks. Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel ashamed of. My name is Carrie Donahue and I'm the ukulele you carried around but never learned how to play. Joining me is the man who taught Feist to count to four, Joff Owen.
Hi.
You gave up at four though.
I did, that was enough, yeah. Four is, I mean, you don't want to get up to ten, do you? That's for rock musicians to get to ten, 11 even.
Well, there was the famous falling out between you and Feist and now she can not count past four. Very sad. So, Joff, you are, as I kindly said as you walked into the studio today, the founding father of twee, I believe.
It was really kind and really incorrect. But I think we predated the revival by a couple of years, probably. So maybe we were part of a revival of it. But we definitely weren't the founding fathers, as people back in 1986 who would be very cross about that.
Okay. So let's spend a moment on your credentials before we get into the meat of twee. You were in a band called The Boy Least Likely 2.
Still am.
Still are, sorry.
I need to remember that. I still am.
Well, you have many musical guises, don't you?
Yeah, and I'm in a country band called Legends of Country. Oh my God, that's got a massive reach suddenly, hasn't it?
I know. You're going to be famous.
I'm going to be huge. How many listeners have you got? Don't tell
like
me. Don't
like
tell
a
me,
lot. Like now a lot. Even if people didn't know they were consciously listening to you, or people have heard a lot of your songs.
Yeah, I would say they've been, like, if you ever seen an advert for a bank where a girl's, like, jumping in puddles, that could be us. Or, yeah, we've been in Easy A, we were in that, and Peter Rabbit.
Oh, wow.
Maybe if you've got children and you've enjoyed Peter Rabbit, the movie, there's a bit where all the rabbits dance in the allotment.
That's us. You?
They're dancing to us. Yeah,
I'm sorry, we're laughing, but that's incredible. Like it is amazing.
Rabbit dancing to us. I know.
Up this like canon of British literature and children's literature is dance to your fucking music.
I know.
Can Johnny Burrell say that?
He can't. No, although he did have a song in Angus Thongs and Perfect Snoggins.
So
he beat us there.
Did you?
Still
you
resentful.
You
still,
were both auditioning for that gig, were you?
Still resentful. Yeah, that they got that. I don't know why we didn't get in that one.
Yeah, it seems perfect.
Pipettes did, so.
Okay.
There was some twee presents.
So, like, the song I think you're probably most known for is Be Gentle With Me.
Staring up into the solar system. I just want to sparkle.
You really hit all of the bingo squares for things to include in a Twee song.
Yeah.
In that you've got the glockenspiel, the banjo, some mouth sounds.
Mouth sounds, but no recorder on this one. We had recorder on other songs. I think the recorder was on the B side, but not on the A side, but there's a lot. I'd say they're the three.
Yeah.
But no ukulele, you see.
No ukulele.
Now, this is interesting because obviously you can actually play ukulele, can you?
No. I can play the guitar, but not the ukulele. Although I assume I can play the ukulele because I can play the
guitar.
It's
quite small, but we've never actually.
Ukuleles really, are small, you say.
And they're quite small. It's quite small for the hands, I think.
Yeah.
I can't play guitar or ukulele, so it's fine.
Okay. Wow.
But we never used a ukulele.
Oh, and yet all those kind of twee sounds and instrumentation kind of do get grouped together, don't they? And the other kind of bingo square that you hit off with that song was just linguistically, the sort of emphasis on sort of, you know, it's called Be Gentle With Me and this sort of childish thing of being afraid of spiders and that kind of thing. It's very sweet, which is a huge, you know, part of what twee culture is about, is gentleness and kindness and sweetness.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know, for some people, twee is an insult. And as far as they're concerned, they're just musicians making songs and being experimental with the kind of instruments they play and the kind of way they make music. And for some people, it was like a scene and they're ready to accept it was a scene and they're quite proud about it. And I think you're in the latter category.
Yeah, well, we're never self-described as twee.
Yeah.
Because it was always used as like an insult against us.
Yeah.
So...
So was it?
And I don't think it's been reclaimed yet. I'm starting to see people reclaim it a little bit.
Yeah.
This band Heavenly have got these T-shirts that say "Riot Twee" on.
And I feel Riot Twee. Yeah.
So that feels like this sort of, maybe people are starting to, or just accept that it gets thrown at us. But we never self-described. We were just indie pop. That was just.
Yeah.
But Americans love Twee. I think Americans invented Twee,
I think,
you see.
So.
I don't remember any bands calling themselves Twee over here, but then Americans were straight away calling us Twee. But they didn't think it was a bad thing.
Yeah. So the definition of Twee, I think, you probably had to deal with this a lot over the years. What would we say the definition of Twee is?
Okay, it's childlike imagery, amateurishness for me was and a sort of DIY approach. It was sort of non-sexual.
Yeah,
that's definitely a thing. Like friendship was more probably pushed. And there's probably other. So yeah, childlike.
Yeah, and do we think that it was? Okay, first of all, sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself with my theories as always. always a fucking theory on this podcast. First of all, what I'm so interested in is your perspective on this, is that like I'm quite used to on this podcast doing this thing where like here's something very feminine that women have liked and loved and that has been taken away from them or you know, made to feel silly about it. And what I'm really curious about is that as a guy making music in this environment, this like quite, you know, feminine, gentle, sort of non-sexual or whatever, it sort of goes against what guitar music is supposed to be and what a man is supposed to do when he has a guitar or when he's, you know, making any kind of indie music or whatever. I know you don't play guitar, but
just remind listeners, he does not play guitar.
This charlatan in the studio today. I can't believe I'm a better musician than you. And you had Rashida Jones in your music video.
And tell her.
What drove you to make this kind of music and what was the experience of it?
It was kind of, I mean, I got into it when I was younger, like in the first wave, sort of like 80s, late 80s.
Yeah.
When I was like 12 or 13, I really loved it. And it was just I had a friend at school who got me into it. She was called Chantelle and she had a satchel and a duffel coat and the satchel had a name. So, you know, it was things.
The satchel had a name.
Rupert. He was, God. So it was. So
very
she was into,
head.
Yeah. So she was into it. So I got into it when I was younger. And then it sort of went. I tried being in a rock band with Pete, who's the other one in the Boy Who Slightly Too. And we tried being rock and having guitars. And it didn't really, it didn't really sit with me.
Yeah.
In terms of what was expected of me as a man in a rock band, or what was sort of going on, the exchange between me and the audience. There's that sort of thing about the sort of great male rock artists which I couldn't really get on board with. The seriousness of that, the sort of to be taken seriously, I didn't really... It's not that I didn't want people to take the records seriously, yeah. but me, I didn't want them... I didn't ever want that, really. And indie pop was never about that.
So what, when you were trying that outfit on, what were you kind of looking to... What were you trying to emulate and... Why exactly did... Obviously, I totally understand that self-seriousness thing of like, you know, if, trying to be Bruce Springsteen and trying to write about sort of like institutional poverty and trying to get out of this town and all this stuff.
Yeah, it was... I mean, we were probably trying to be like the Clash or the Manix.
Right.
I think there's that weird thing that people in... Men in rock bands do. And actually, I think women in rock bands, there's that sort of thing like they want... It's about sort of this weird admiration between the audience admiring the rock star and them sort of being misunderstood in some way. And I wasn't really interested in that. Whereas indie pop, Twee gave me a... The lyrics are very simple. That's the weird thing about indie pop. Like, there's no sort of misunderstanding. You know what they're singing about. It's very childlike and simplest, like lyrically simple. So...
You've just said so many things that I want to ask you about.
Okay.
I'm really very, wow. Let's go back to this idea of like, because I think this is, you've really got to the heart of something that I'm trying to probe around in my own research, but I haven't really got to, which is with this rock star thing. It is, you're right. It's totally about this kind of, we're on stage and you worship us.
Yeah.
And like, whether that's in like, you know, the O2 Arena or in just some boozer in Camden or something, that atmosphere is like, you must worship me, like or whatever. And I do feel like for this whole generation around the kind of early noughties and that kind of thing, that just felt such like a silly thing to ask for or for to want or to embody. That moment felt like, ooh, why?
It was definitely, yeah, the enemy was definitely full of that sort of, the sort of 2000s to 2009. It was all those bands and it was weird. I don't understand that. So I don't understand what drives anyone to sort of want to sort of be misunderstood.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing to want. But you need to be misunderstood to be a great and serious male artist.
Yeah.
That's why I'm not a great and serious male artist.
So when you start writing Boy Least Likely 2 songs, when you hit on that sort of formula, was it a feeling of like release or joy of being like, oh, we can just be silly?
Yeah, I mean, the lyrics were always quite dark. I always felt like Pete was the silly one. He was making very upbeat sound, you know, because he was sort of bringing in ABBA and ELO and all these other big influences into it, mixed with the sort of Twee instrumentation. But the lyrics were always quite dark. I mean, they were kind of dealing with sort of the fear of adulthood, the fear of growing up, fear of being alone. I was driven by fear.
Definitely. And you definitely hear that in the lyrics, particularly on Be Gentle With Me. You're right. There is a darkness to it. It's simple, but it's dark. You know what I mean? It's very upfront about how it feels about itself. And that's, again, you've hit on something else huge about this, which is so much of Twee is characterized by a childlikeness, and it's the instrumentation and even the album art as well you had it on your albums, but this sort of hand-drawn quality.
Yeah.
Why do you think that so many people, or at the same time, some people in their sort of early 20s or whatever, felt this sudden rush to go back to this kind of primary colours, Sesame Street sort of vibe?
I think it was kind of, I mean, at the time, it was at that time, sort of early 2000s, it was like, so for women, you had raunch culture, which was just seemed. I mean, it was that sort of its height, and that's quite a sort of, that was sort of dominating culture. And for men, you had NME sort of men and rock culture. These were the two, and it feels like it was battling against that. It was almost not even battling against it. It was just like taking yourself out of the fight and saying, "We'll just do this over here. You can do what you like. We'll do this."
This is a quote I came across when I was reading about this that I've been thinking about a lot, which was, and obviously everything that happens in the 2000s begins, anyone doing the sort of like laziest social commentary on it will always begin with, in the aftermath of 9/11. And you can kind of root everything back to that, I suppose. And like, I guess it's the same with the sort of Vietnam generation or whatever. But the quote that this person came across was, or gave was, you know, there was this, there being the sense of you can't affect anything, and the world feeling so huge and so chaotic, and people in charge feeling, I mean, there was that whole kind of era of George Bush being very publicly an idiot, and that being back then quite a new thing for an American president to be like publicly an idiot. The war in Iraq feeling so obviously corrupt and so driven by profiteering, and then the urge to make twee things and to make little things and DIY things, and having a self-contained scene, was the urge to make something small within something big.
Yeah, I definitely think that is like the world just felt huge and sort of beyond. We couldn't really, I mean, I think that now that you can't really make an imprint on it.
Yeah, more and more.
And so you just end up doing your own thing in your own corner to the people of your village. And that's kind of what, I mean, that's what we started out doing. I genuinely didn't think we'd be successful.
So when was the moment? When was the success moment? This is very each run
with
stories.
We'd made like a few 7-inches and put them out, and they'd sort of had, you know, the village liked them, I think it was probably Pitchfork. I mean, we were Rough Trade Album of the Month and stuff. So that was nice.
Wow.
And we'd
been
in Vogue. I mean, I think our first press was Vogue. It was awful.
Why?
Because it was great to be in Vogue, but I wasn't prepared to what to wear for a Vogue photo shoot. I had like a straw hat on and a biker jacket. I got it so wrong. It was sort of like a Johnny Knoxville bumpkin, but it was awful. Yeah. I was up a tree.
Of course. Anyway. Of course you were up a tree.
But it was nice of them to have us in there. And then we were in in Sunday Times Style and Elle magazine. So it was weird that the places that people were coming to us from.
So very fittingly for this podcast, it was women's media.
Yeah. To begin with. And then, I mean, I think it always, and our fan base is still 70% women. And it was always like men would come up to us and say like, oh, you're the band that I don't mind coming to see with my girlfriend.
Oh, wow.
Which is so nice of them.
But then, I mean, is it? It's kind of a neg.
I mean, at least they were happy to be there.
That's true. That's true. That reminds me of when men come up to me at book signings because they've come with their girlfriend and they're like, yeah, I don't usually use this kind of thing, but I might read this.
Yeah.
Like, thank you. Thank you for this faint praise you have damned me with.
So we did have, and weirdly, then I mean, there are some male fans who are, and they're very passionate. They're the sort of, they're the ones that grab me by the shoulders in a field somewhere to tell me I changed their life.
Oh, wow. That's so beautiful.
Which is really nice. Yeah. I don't really get that from the female fans.
That's okay. So,
which is fine. I didn't want that, remember, because I'm not a great and serious male artist.
I am not a great and serious man. Certainly.
I mean, I do, you know, but actually, women have a lot of the tattoos. The boys like to do tattoos.
I can imagine that because your album artwork is so playful and easy to
get a tattoo of. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is great. Yeah.
Great marketing.
Plus, you get into a show for life if you have a boys like to do tattoo for free.
Oh.
So we do like one every 2 years.
So you get into this band specifically because you're working against that sort of great and serious rock star thing, and then you immediately have a female fan base and women's media after you. So it's kind of like, I don't know, you've accidentally tricked the system.
I know.
Something.
Well, that's the thing. Am I then sort of like tapping into some sort of soft boy thing?
Yeah.
I mean, is that what I've done?
Is that what you've done?
Is that behind the whole thing? Was I subconsciously trying to get women?
Yes. Were you?
No. I mean, I was.
I mean, come on. You must have a bit.
I was happy to have like women as the main audience.
Yeah.
Because I understand. I get on better with women, and I understand nothing about men and the way men enjoy music, because I think this is obviously going to be like very sweeping, but I think like women sort of enjoy it passionately and men want to enjoy it in a sort of knowledgeable way.
Oh, wow.
And they want to sort of, you know, they want to know everything about it and open up the bonnet of the car and sort of go through and then be clever about it. And I don't think that's the same from the way women listen to music.
That is fucking fascinating. You've really got to something there, not just in Twee, but in everything.
Yeah, I mean, there's different... I hope I have.
No, I really think you have.
I hope I have something really, really wrong. But you can always edit it out.
I really do get what you're getting at, because and you know, that's what this whole podcast is about, is, yeah. as you know, is the sort of just the passionate loving of things. And I have noticed that over the years, and of the many boyfriends I've had, and so many of those boyfriends were responsible for like getting me into a band or whatever. And you know, I think about someone, I mean, Bright Eyes, for example.
Love Bright Eyes.
Everyone loves Bright Eyes. I remember an ex-boyfriend getting me into Bright Eyes when I was a teenager, and you know, our sort of putting on, you know, the first day of my life, because he's kind of queuing up a kiss kind of thing, and you know, all that stuff. And then I remember that band sort of like laying an egg in my heart then, and just like so many of my teenage memories are just like me in my room screaming to that song, Let's Not Chill Ourselves. And just so many of that song just moved me so much. And then I would go to him with all this feeling that I had, yeah. about this band that he had sort of given to me. And I was like, oh my God, like I just can't. Connor is in, I don't know. I don't know how he does it. He's so young. He's so handsome. And him just being very like already very like crossing his arms, being like, well, yeah, you know, I mean, Lifted was produced actually in Tim Cash's basement, da, 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 and it being all this sort of like pitchfork.com
yeah.
thing. And it, looking back now, it makes me feel a little bit sad, because I think, you know, loving something passionately, openly, so much that you bring yourself to tears every time you talk about it, yeah. is a pleasure for women. I think, yeah. it's hard for men to do that in public, hard to love things openly like that.
Okay, yeah,
I feel sorry for you.
I don't enjoy music. I don't like to take it apart. I don't like to be clever about it. Well, yeah. I mean, I can like learn about it. I don't mind, but it's not. I do feel like more affinity with that sort of passion, that sort of passionate way of looking at it.
Yeah,
the way of a song just like inexplicably, just really get into you, and you're not really. I don't feel like I've ever needed to explain why I like things. I just love them.
Who made you, Joe? Did you grow up in like a coven of sisters who didn't let you go outside?
My mum just had a lot of friends who just had daughters. So right. when I was growing up, I just had like friends who were girls.
I love. And so it got like raised with girls. Men.
I think it was basically. And when I went to school, I was shocked at the behaviour of boys.
Was it all boys' school?
No, that would be madness. That, but they, I was just
you
shocked.
Wouldn't be here today. You'd be locked in a trunk in a boarding school somewhere still.
I was just shocked at they'd come in combats, because you didn't have to wear uniforms, so they'd be there in combats and
yeah.
with guns and
guns,
cars, like toys, guns and cars.
Okay.
And I had a horse, a Cindy horse, which I loved, and I'd take it everywhere Joe. With me. I only had three legs, so it was quite a desperate. It's again quite a Twee icon.
Cindy horse.
And I just loved horses so much, but I remember the other boys would not even like, even then I remember it being quite a moment I realized we weren't on the same wavelength.
I just want to go back in time and have you be my son. You're like, the little boy I dream of raising.
I'm sure I was a very sensitive, delicate flower who needed a lot of care.
Okay, so the delicate flower who needs a lot of care tries rock music, and then finds that indie rock and Twee and indie pop and whatever. And then you're on stage and you're looking out in a position you did not want to be, an adored serious man who's like got a distance between himself and the audience. And then you look down into your audience, and what do they look like? What are they wearing?
So I'm looking out at the audience, and yeah, there's a lot of polka dot dresses. There's satchels. There's anoraks.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't. I don't remember it being like a sort of uniform yet. This is the weird. I don't remember. I feel like this sort of the aesthetic of Twee in the sort of 2000s mm-hmm. comes later. It was quite a mismatch. I remember doing like the video for Be Gentle With Me and having to explain to a stylist what a like cutie or a Twee girl looked like. No idea.
Really?
So
what year is this?
That's 2005.
Yeah, that would be before the explosion, really, yeah, which I think is probably 2008, 2009, yeah. Really. So you were there sowing the seeds.
And I was trying to, and I was sort of finding pictures of like Amelia Fletcher from Tallulah Gosh being like, they look like this. And I was like, oh, okay. And she got it completely wrong for the video.
Wow. Well, really laying out your female stylist. Know what?
No,
not that I are obviously. You, Cindy Horse.
Obviously not completely wrong, but she...
No, I get it though.
But she didn't... I mean, she looks great in the video, but yeah.
No, but no, I yeah, this whole thing of like noticing the tendrils of a scene sort of starting to knit themselves together, really, but they aren't... I guess we're still talking about something that's pretty underground, right? Like this is very much like a, I'm going to assume, MySpace and music blogs driven thing, right? In researching this episode, I found a lot of like dot blog spots that were covering a lot of these gigs, and like I had a blog spot and sort of the hand drawn you know, graphics and everything looking a bit like yarn on the toe, whatever, and like my favorite gigs, and I imagine like obviously there was the Vogue and the Elle stuff, but I imagine there was quite a network of like underground blogs run by 17-year-old girls. Absolutely going fucking hog wild for you.
Yeah, there was definitely, yeah, it was definitely blogs running up to that. Yeah, yeah. Definitely. And they, yeah, they, I don't know if they're going wild for us, but they were. And yeah, there's a lot of men on blogs.
Yeah.
Too, going wild for, they were going wild for us in a clever way. Yeah, so it was definitely a lot of blog stuff. Sort of 2005, album comes out on Pitchfork, cover it, and that's where it, which is like the ultimate blog, Pitchfork.
Yeah, of course.
It's that sort of blog writing elevated to...
And what do they say?
They loved it.
Yes!
New music of the week or whatever it was.
That's unbelievable. 8.5.
I know. And that was the one, that was the moment where I feel like things changed. Definitely for us, but maybe yeah. That was when the sort of the sinks and the adverts and the films started coming. Oh, and I feel like that's when sort of it became a little bit main. I'm not saying it was just us.
No, there's definitely a tipping point. Yeah.
Yeah. It's when, that's the point where like twee becomes cool.
Okay.
Before like it becomes cool to be twee, which is like a different, it's a curve. So it's,
explain more.
So, well,
I love this.
So when twee, things are already twee, become yeah. cool, yeah. that's fine. When it becomes cool to be twee,
yes.
It's on the downside because it's not authentic anymore. It's people.
Okay.
And I'm not.
No. Of yeah. course, we're talking in broad terms. But
and
yes.
I'm not saying it's not inauthentic. Cause I think twee's very anti-authenticity. That's one of its other things. Is it's like that idea of authenticity. It's sort of playing with that.
Go on. What does that mean?
It's that sort of on all like the authenticity of punk as well, which takes its DIY from punk.
Yeah.
But then it takes. It's just sort of any sort of. It's amateur. It's like anti-rockist. You know the yeah. term rockist, that sort of, which is about sort of, yeah, being authentic and like rock music being the authentic genre and yeah. pop music being inauthentic. Well, indie pop's kind of taking that stance, the sort of anti-rock, anti-authenticity, because the idea of the sort of, that's part of the great male artist is the they're authentic.
Yeah.
But they're not really authentic to themselves. They're just authentic to an idea of authenticity.
Yes, yes, it's a vision that's been created for the mass idea of yeah. what an authentic person is.
Yeah, but it's
but
not
it's a manicured thing.
Yeah, because it's not. That's why, and I think that is that when we were trying to be like the Clash or the Manics,
yeah,
we were trying to be authentic, but it wasn't authentic to me.
Yeah,
it wasn't authentic to that boy with the Cindy horse. so yeah, it was. That's what twee was against. That it kind of plays with that idea of authenticity. It ridicules it. It's irreverent and it ridicules that idea of being a rock star, an authentic rock star. Bobby Gillespie in an anorak before he's a rock star is wearing an anorak with leather trousers is a funny thing to do, and he knows that.
Yeah,
but
yeah. And do we think like I was thinking about sort of like places in the culture where maybe there were sort of seeds of it before we knew what to call it. And I think a lot about that Coldplay Yellow video, right? Of just Chris Martin alone on the beach with his big bug eyes, you know, wearing like, and like, even if you look back on that, you can see how people thought that they were going to be the next Radiohead, right? Like,
yeah.
It's like quite a bold thing to do in that year. I can't remember what year that came out, but it is sort of that moment of like, there's something very, very exposing and like quite, in a world where pop is so manicured, like it's that sort of heightened to the Britney era, the Christian era, everything is so and I like this about pop. I like that you're getting this whole.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Visual tableau that goes with the music, and that's part of loving pop music.
Yeah.
And rock music is that sort of, even the Libertines were sort of sputtering out at this point, and like they were being held up by the enemy as like the authentic sort of thing, and that was even a production. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was like them being these like coked out, constantly fighting best friends was a tableau in itself. And so like having Chris Barton in The Beach in the Rain felt like such a, it's quite breathtaking. Do you know what I mean? For someone to be so visibly uncool, unsexy, unbothered, and so earnest. And I do think Twee has its roots, that wave of Twee has its roots in that moment a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Martin as a Twee icon's not sitting well with me.
You can totally disagree with me, but I think there's something in it.
I think there's definitely something in that sort of sensitive man that's coming through. I think him as sort of this sensitive, and what's great about him, which is quite Twee, he's not Twee, but is that Twee's quite anti-cool. I think that's another thing that drives Twee, which is sort of because cool and authenticity, and they run their, you know, they run together. Chris Martin not being cool is definitely part of that, because cool's another thing at that time, like you've got the Enemy cool list and stuff, where they'd bring, you know, they'd have all their, you know, the people who were cool, and just the idea of being cool, like indie pop and Twee comes from not wanting to be cool, mainly because
you can't be.
Yeah. So you feel me? So you're like, well, we'll do something else.
Yeah.
Because we can't be that. Because we don't want to be what you think is cool.
Taking ourselves out of the race, exactly.
And that's the other thing where it becomes like, where Twee becomes cool. And then when it becomes cool to be Twee, it's different because it becomes a caricature of cuteness or whatever.
Yes. Okay, let's talk more about that tipping point. Okay. So we know your personal tipping point, which was the Pitchfork moment, which I can't imagine. How old were you when that happened?
Older than you'd think. I was like older than you'd think. My trajectory, I was like 30. So I'm not
still. It must have been like, it must be an odd thing to be like 30 and being a new music of the week person. Like,
yeah, to get new anything when you're 30 is quite exciting.
I mean, Self Esteem, who we're also talking to for this, like, she's been around forever and she's like being hailed as like a new and emerging artist at, you know, 30,
which is amazing.
Whatever. Incredible.
And like, it gives me so much hope. I hope that extends into the 40s. So that was just a weird day when that happened to us. We just came home and there from work, and there were just loads of emails from Americans and American labels, because you could still sell CDs then.
Of course.
Amazing. So we'd sell like, you know, tens of thousands of CDs to American shops, and it was great. You could actually make, you know, but it was like a little cottage industry.
Yeah.
But I think like in terms of what had come to this moment, it's probably like, I mean, I feel like the Moldy Peaches were pretty important in this.
So, okay, what year is this?
So we're talking, for us, it's like 2004, right as it turns to 2005. But we started doing things in 2003. But the Moldy Peaches must be 2001.
Yeah, but obviously a huge tipping point of It's Cool to Be Twee is the Juno soundtrack.
Yeah, which comes out, what's that, 2006? 2005, 2006?
Yeah.
We were on the trailer for it. We didn't make the soundtrack.
Bitch. That's what?
I know.
You were on the trailer? That's not
trailer.
Fair. That's not fair.
I know you still get paid, but it's like, I just want to be on the... No one's like, everyone's, oh, should we watch Juno? Oh, should we watch, like, should we watch the trailer first, though? We should watch the trailer first. They shouldn't. Or we could just watch the trailer.
Oh, my God. I can't wait to go look up the trailer.
Yeah.
This is incredible. So that, yeah, that was, I mean, so for me, Juno, I was a teenager and loved the movie. And also had an immediate resentful thing of like the adults in my life, because that was like, you know, it was such a huge breakout. It was like a Little Miss Sunshine moment. You know, Diablo Cody was one of the, like, a screenwriter who became a celebrity because of, she was such an unusual voice, an unusual person. And it was everywhere. I think it got lots of Oscar nominations. And I remember the adults in my life being like, this is very you. You know, and that's, I think that's a real moment, because obviously it's a moment for me. So, yeah. So therefore, everyone should care about the nuances of my biographical details. But that thing of Juno, and particularly the Juno soundtrack, summarized a lot of things that was happening in my bedroom anyway. So like guitars talking like someone, like an American on the internet, and reading a fuckload of blogs and that kind of stuff. Reading kind of things, what, like American literature that was quite iconoclastic, and it, once again, as you said before, playing with the idea of authenticity. So I'm thinking like Dave Eggers and The Heartbreaking Work of a Staggering Genius, Jonathan Safran Foer's Everything is Illuminated, like sort of the great serious soft boys of American literature were very much in my bedroom, playing the guitar a lot and listening to a lot of folk music and anti-folk and Jeffrey Lewis and that kind of stuff. And my parents were like, oh, we recognize this mainstream moment as being part of our teenage daughter's oeuvre. And that being like, I like this movie, but I'm also resentful. And I think that's a real moment when something becomes mainstream, right?
Yeah, it's pretty upsetting. It is upsetting.
It's upsetting.
It's really upsetting for the subculture when the subculture goes, you know, when you and you feel like your little thing is suddenly popular. It was upsetting for me. And I was... Yeah, I mean,
you were part. You were the trailer,
and I was to blame in some. You know,
you were working in the factory.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Like the things, like when people started to talk about like Sarah Records, my favorite label, which has been the sort of my secret. You know,
yeah,
it became quite upsetting.
Yeah,
and I was.
Why blame. Is it upsetting? Do we think?
Because it means your identity sort of becomes commodified in some way.
Yeah.
And that's upsetting, isn't it? Because you sort of feel like you can't be, you know, what the things that are special to you shouldn't be, unless they already were.
Yeah.
But, you know, they and those things like the books and things, it is sort of like the twee culture is kind of bookish and sort of just finds these funny little things it's into. And it's all about that sort of, that treasure hunt for weird little things that then you put together on your MySpace wall.
And then what I always think of as well is like the weird little things that feel so iconoclastic and so it's a tweet is very much a curated experience about finding the little things, but even those little things are from a bank of books that have been selected by the people at HMV to put on the table. You know, it's like A Girlfriend in a Coma by Douglas Coupland or whatever. So that's I can't quite wrap my head around that. So okay, the Juno moment. So you're making money off of this, right? Like this must have been a pretty profitable time for you guys, right?
Yeah, weirdly unsuspected. No one was like expecting.
And so are we quitting our jobs? Yeah. Are we going out on the road? Are we kissing our babies goodbye?
Like by the end of 2005, we had like a publishing deal and a record deal. We were signed to like Simon Fuller, Spice Girls manager. He started a label, so we signed with his label. Because there were no men worked there.
No men worked
of his label. It was amazing because most, you go into most record labels, you meet some A&R, you know, guy.
Yeah.
Complete chonker, and he's like there, you know, giving you the whole. And it's just like, it was quite refreshing to go to a label where there were no men.
But do you have the simultaneous thing of like, your twee has become mainstream, my parents are being annoying about it to me. You're making a living as an artist, which is incredible, but you're still having this resentment that this thing that you love and have nursed the sort of like the tendrils of and has now become this mass product. So what's it like to have those things happening simultaneously? And I mean, was there resentment from other people as well?
Yeah, I think that, I don't know if there, I mean, we found it quite hard to do the sort of, to be indie as we were, and then to do things like signed with Simon Fuller.
Yeah.
Because they don't go hand in hand, but it felt like that was another thing about Twee that I always liked, or indie pop with it. It was kind of annoying. Like it didn't mind poking the bear. It was like quite like, and even its own fan base, yeah, it would sort of do things that maybe were a little bit annoying.
Like what?
I just remember the shows, like for the bands I went to see when I, like, it was, they would sort of shout at each other. You know, they would be like, people would heckle, they would shout back. It was like, yeah, something they would, and I think just that was sort of tapped into our sort of idea of maybe being a bit annoying. But then you'd be surprised when the bear attacks you back. You're like, oh, I didn't think you'd do that. I've just been annoying to be fun.
Do you think that what people found annoying was the sort of the...
So just talking about the ways we've been annoying. do you think what's annoying about you?
See, what people don't take to about you. No, actually, sorry, this is probably a valuable segue, but like, I've wanted to do this episode for a really long time, and I usually don't tweet looking for guests. I started off sort of emailing people or whatever, but the thing about doing an episode on Twee is that, like, you have to be very careful with who you call Twee, because, yeah, you have to be very... I emailed quite a lot of musicians who were active during this time. I got a lot of bounce backs, and basically everybody ignored me. And,
you can always rely on me.
But yeah, a mutual friend actually set us up, which was brilliant. But that's the thing of, like, it was... people were vicious about this kind of music. I read quite a few reviews of things, not of you, but of like Lost Camp in particular, who kind of came in 2008-2009. And at one point, by The Quietus, were called reverse engineered pedophilia.
Yeah, I mean, that's really mean. I don't know. That's and they were quite rocky,
right?
They were loud.
They could go quite hardcore. They were loud. Yeah, they were loud. Yeah.
Yeah. So God knows what The Quietus would have thought of us. I'm not even going to look that up. I don't remember being that universally hated. I must admit, like...
This is so funny because, like, I was talking to Self-Esteem about this, and she remembers feeling quite... feel quite ashamed, really. But I guess you weren't.
Not... Maybe our PR people just never showed me those ones. Like, The Enemy hated us.
Really?
That they hate us. And they wrote to our... like our PR guy and said, we actually quite enjoyed the show.
Yeah.
But we're never going to write about them because they're the most un-enemy band ever. Which obviously we put that straight in quotes on the press release. But
that is brilliant.
I was really proud of that. So The Enemy were always nasty and they gave us 3 out of 10, which was really mean.
That's really...
And I can't even find that review, and obviously I didn't keep a copy of it. So I don't know. I don't remember in what way they were mean. But everyone else was fine. Pitchfork were nice to us. And,
yeah,
and the broadsheets were always nice to us. And people wouldn't... That's the weird thing. Maybe I only kept the nice ones. But I was looking through trying to find some bad ones so I could, yeah, say just how mean people have been to me. And actually,
that's
not
the way your brain
in.
Works. It's quite lovely that you just clearly don't hang on to these things.
Yeah, and I guess... Yeah, and our PR guy obviously didn't either. He didn't send them to us. Because I looked through, I searched all his emails. He didn't ever send us a bad one. But I guess they were out there.
Yeah. But I didn't find any. So. No.
We were universally loved.
But it's interesting because I think you're right in that, like, Americans felt more welcoming of the genre.
Yeah.
In general.
They didn't really see a problem with it. It wasn't like an affront to their masculinity, yeah, for male rock journalists over there to like us.
Yeah. And, like, I guess there was just so... And there was so much coming out of there. Like your Bright Eyes or whatever. And there was, you know, Saddle Creek Records, who were, like, putting out colouring books.
Yeah. We never did that. Yeah. And that's really Twee.
This is actually something I'm very interested in, is, I think, something that helped create the Twee aesthetic was the fact that there is tote bags. I think Twee is responsible for tote bags, yeah, in a way that we will never quite appreciate.
Yeah.
Like, people remember that moment in the noughties of, like, this is not a plastic bag bags, but, yeah, like, yeah, like, bands putting out their own sort of tote bags or whatever, that became such a signifier,
yeah,
for a certain kind of person who listens to music. And, you know, kind of t-shirts that were looked very kind of homemade or whatever, badges. And it was this real merchandising boom that happened, that it really exploded as CD sales were falling. So it was like bands trying to close the gap by putting, like, basically becoming a mini Urban Outfitters.
Yeah, basically. And they would, I remember a band we toured with called The Bicycles, they'd sewed sleeves to put all their CDs in.
Yeah.
So little bags, everything came with a little bag, which was really nice. But it did sort of, because CDs were always quite ugly, and I think people have sort of suddenly realised they didn't have to buy all these sort of weird plastic things. They could just download it or steal it.
Yeah.
Which is, so you had to sort of entice them in a different way. It'd be like, with a badge or a hand-sewn CD cover. It was, there was a lot of that, definitely. That's what it was quite nice. I was kind of like the sort of cottage industry thing.
Yeah.
I mean, did Etsy exist? Did I invent Etsy?
I think you may have.
Oh, amazing. What a life.
Did you... What a huge life you had. Did you feel like... I remember a lot of bands around this time having blogs, or like really... like Amanda Palmer or Kimya Dawson having this real direct relationship with their fans. And that sort of added to the sort of, even though Amanda Palmer wouldn't call her Twee, it added to the sort of aesthetic of like, we're just a big family in here. We're all just having a laugh. Come have some jelly in a cup, you know?
Yeah.
And did you feel like you had to do that, or did you do that?
No, I had a blog.
Yeah. Which,
and I loved my blog. And it was definitely something, but that came from like fanzine culture. Yeah. Fanzine culture was the same sort of thing in the 80s. Like all the people that were running labels were also running fanzines. The fanzines sort of gave birth to the labels that then became active. Like Sarah Records was like two fanzines coming together to make a record label, which then kind of had the same feeling as a fanzine. So the blog was just an extension of fanzines and like tape swapping and all that stuff that went on in the 80s. Just when it went to like MP3 file sharing and blogs.
It's that sort of like that poison chalice of streaming, right? Because obviously everybody knows streaming has ruined the music industry. It has made it not an industry, but kind of a hobby now because it's just so hideously difficult to get paid for music now. But at the same time, is there this kind of upside? I don't know. I hesitate to say upside. But for me, like streaming was the thing that took me out of sort of mainstream radio listenership, in that like having LimeWire and downloading all these songs, that because I didn't, it was maybe the kind of the golden era of streaming, in that like downloading a song would take 4 or 5 minutes, downloading an album could take a day, kind of thing. So you were quite sparing with how you did it, and so you would download a couple of Bright Eyes songs or a couple of Chairlift songs or Regina Spektor song. Remember Chairlift?
I do remember Chairlift.
And then you would like, you would have them on your MP3 player going around in a loop, and then you might go and buy an album, and that gave you access to all this American music. And I remember it was back when America still felt like a really exciting place where exciting things happened, which obviously it sort of feels like not that anymore, but
but it was a scary place though, because it was like 2000s anyway.
Yeah,
but like the idea, it's the golden age of streaming.
Yeah.
Like the when you took a day to... Yeah. But actually it was because you had an iPod. And I was thinking about my iPod earlier and how much I loved curating the iPod.
Yes.
And you'd take stuff off if it didn't work. Because if you just press like play all, what happens if, you know, what happens if Golden Touch comes on?
I you know? Still love that song.
Oh, I met a girl with a golden touch. It's so creepy.
Oh, or, I guess it is creepy.
It's just something a bit weird about it. It's just like, I just think,
You toured with Larry Hoodlie, didn't you?
Yeah, Andy, it's actually the drummer from Razor. Andy is on drums on the first Body Slide 2 album.
Oh, hello.
Probably the second too.
You're a rock pedigree.
Yeah, so we can be taken seriously as rock musicians, you see? Because we know a rock star. But it was like, I remember having like a sort of e-music account. Did you have one of those?
No.
Where you got like 50 credits a month and you'd really carefully select what songs you'd done, and then you put them on the iPod. But it felt more fun than streaming. I wonder now if this is streaming so easy. The weird thing, I suppose, for people now is to try and encourage people to buy something from them.
Yeah.
Because you need some sort of income. So everyone's like, I sell a lot of badges.
Everyone in a band, it's kind of going to be a cliche now, isn't it? Of like, what's the hardest thing about being in a band? Being a t-shirt company.
Yeah, basically. That's basically it, yeah.
Yeah.
That you kind of need to do that because, no one's really buying your music. But I think that's...
That's something that Twee got out in front of, because everything... because people identified so strongly, because a lot of the singers and songwriters and musicians had blogs and identities and personalities, and that was the first time that we could really do that, of like, you know, reading Kimya Dawson's tour diary. And like, I remember, I have this very like strong memory of reading about how she was really struggling with reusable nappies for her child.
That's great.
And just being like, yeah, that being this weird thing of like, this person who is huge and on the Juno soundtrack, yeah, and has really sort of changed how girls are writing songs in their bedrooms, which I think is no small thing, is also just struggling with childcare, and I'm reading about it at 2 a.m. in my house in Ireland, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that really blew my mind. And so I think Twee then, having even a shit drawing on a t-shirt by an artist felt so amazing.
Yeah.
And particularly after, you know, big CD, big music or whatever, of everything being so gleaming and shiny, and like going to sort of a Britney concert and having just sort of a print of her face on the t-shirt and that's it, and Britney will never know.
Yeah. She would never know. She wouldn't know. But if you buy like K Records, like you could buy a t-shirt where Calvin from had drawn the cat. He drew it, and you'd seen the picture of him drawing them.
Yes.
So you knew, so that felt so special. And even like, and even if you're buying a Moldy Peaches, I bought a Moldy Peaches t-shirt off Kimya at a gig, because she was working the merch store and she was there. And it did feel like there was sort of a smaller community. But then as that community gets bigger, then, you know, the one you get to know in the whale, you're not buying a t-shirt off.
Yeah. So okay, we were going on the timeline. Let me see how much speed of time. We are so over time.
But okay. Yeah.
So we've talked about the sort of the peak of like everything exploding and musicians making a really quite decent living off of this. And then where does culture really turn to the point where it becomes a bit like, oh God, do you know what I mean?
I feel like, I don't want to land them in it, but I feel like, well, I don't know, because there's like a few things where I think that it becomes mainstream, and there's Knowing the Whale, that 5 years time song.
Yes.
Feels like that for me is the point where it's cool to be Twee, and it's not, I do quite like the song, but I'm also like, what are you doing? Going to see the fucking elephants.
Oh,
at your age.
Wow. Oh my God. You lived long enough to see yourself become the villain.
I know. No, I don't mean.
No, I do. I think you're right, though. I think that was the tipping point.
And then I think they gave themselves away by going all Springsteen on the next album.
Yes.
And it's like, so you wanted to be great and serious male rock artists all along. Knew it.
Just for parity, Noah and the Whale were one of the people who did not respond to my emails.
Exactly. And that's exactly why we...
What I find so haunting about that song, because you're right, it was when Twee really hit Radio 1 in a big way of like... And yeah, you're right, the ukuleles, the 5 years' time, we'll be walking around a zoo. But what I find strangely prophetic about that song is that obviously Laura Marling is on that song.
Yeah.
She used to be in that band. She used to date that guy. And then in 5 years' time, this girl in the band will be like hailed as the next Joni Mitchell, and probably is the next Joni Mitchell. Like, she's like one of the most iconic folk singers of her generation.
Yeah.
And you will be a joke.
And she, exactly. And she doesn't give it. She doesn't care about those fucking elephants. She's not going to. She's not going to the zoo with you. Because she's kind of Twee, like that first EP.
Ghosts was such a very Twee song.
Yeah, New Romantic.
Yes.
But then I feel bad calling that Twee, because it's just like simple.
It's great, but it's also like story-led sort of songs that feel a bit like fables as well.
Yeah, but it's story-led and it's simple, so it's actually, it could be country as well. You know, it's like traditional country is the same thing. It's story-led and it's simple, understandable lyrics.
Sad when Laura Marling became a serious artist.
And that's the thing, because I was sort of listening to her.
I love that album, The First, The Best,
And as you listen to her music, it gets more difficult to understand immediately. There's something about those early singles where you're just like, I get it, I know what she's singing about.
Yeah.
And as it goes on, you're like, I might need to have some sort of...
Laura Marling is the serious man of Twee.
Yeah, oh God, this is awful.
You'll probably have to see her again.
I've turned against women now. It's just...
You hate women. right, we've talked a lot about a lot of different stuff, and I'm just very excited by all of it. What's next for Twee? Because the reason that prompted this whole episode is that it's coming back.
Yeah.
We could call Cottagecore, we could call Twee.
Yeah.
Dark Academia has sort of elements of Twee. Do you know about this?
I do not know about Dark Academia. What is that?
So I write YA, so yeah. I have a sort of finger in those pies.
Yeah.
Dark Academia is sort of based on the secret history and all these kind of sort of like preppy but with a goth edge.
Okay.
The idea of like berets and lots of black coffee and knowing a lot about classics.
Right.
In a sort of like a wry way.
Okay. That's quite... That sounds
it's Twee,
like,
but someone's been murdered. Is the
thing. It sounds like sort of bookishness, which is sort of like, although Twee was bookish, it was never... I think that's what Americans got a little bit wrong when they did Twee.
Yeah.
They weren't quite announced like the whole of America. is that they got... It was quite bookish and quite clever and a bit arty and a bit more like hipster. Yeah. And even when I read things about Twee now, they're just talking about hipsters. Like sort of that whole...
Yes.
Like, they're not like when people sort of saying, you know, beard oil, that is not Twee. Like, but they sort of get lumped in together, and there's sort of that because it's bookish and it comes from sort of like Morrissey and things, and you know,
and it might look the same,
yeah.
It looks like a guy in a tweedy sort of atmosphere thingy,
yeah,
or whatever.
It looks the same because it's still dressing like your parents and being, but it's not the same because it's still built on that sort of idea of taking yourself seriously and being taken seriously, which is Twee, and being cool as well, which are all non-Twee things,
yeah,
because Twee is anti-cool.
And that's right. It's like, I used to think that Twee was sort of led by a sense of, you know, kindness and sort of wide-eyed innocence and that kind of stuff. But after our chat, I am sort of starting to see now that, like, it is about, like, seeing something that's so obviously cool and making your camp elsewhere kind of thing.
Because hipster's very authentic as well. It's that idea of authentic, you know, going back and dressing like you're from the 1890s, you're growing, but it's that sort of like an authentic idea of what's authentic. And Twee isn't that. Twee is, like, I tell you what's not authentic, a satchel, a duffel coat. You know, these things, because they can't be taken seriously. A recorder, a ukulele, a glockenspiel, these things can't be played, they can't be mastered. You know, you can't master the ukulele. You can only play it kind of badly. A recorder, like, how good can you get a recorder?
That's so true. Yes, and I guess if you're coming out of this, like, guitar solo kind of culture, look at this guy shredding his guitar. It's like, look at me on my recorder.
Yeah, here's my recorder solo. I mean, it's going to sound amazing, but it's also not going to be...
Yeah.
It's going to be difficult for people to go wild.
I love that.
I think, actually, I think it was, like, an Esquire review where they did, like, a sort of like, Twee... from like 2006, where it had like a table going up to 10. Kittens was 10.
Yeah.
Band Sebastian were like 7. Concretes were 3. And we were 9.
9?
Yeah. And they said at first they liked us, but when they came to see us and we had a recorder player, they were like, no, they were out.
Wow.
You know, the recorder player, a woman.
Wow.
Amanda Applewood.
Thank you for your service.
Yeah.
Amanda!
Like, it's Amanda. So, yeah, that, not just a woman. No, it was Amanda Applewood, who's Eva Rice, who was on your podcast.
Who was one of our first ever guests. And,
she was the recorder player.
We got to get her back on. She's the best.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with that woman.
Should get her on to talk about recorders.
Before we go, what is your favourite Twee song that isn't your own?
5 years' time. No, I think that Moldy Peaches. What's the big one? You cut this bit out while I remind me.
My favourite Moldy Peaches song is I Like Giants.
How's that one? What is it?
I like giants, especially girl giants, because all girls feel too big sometimes, regardless of their size.
Oh, God, that's really good, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's really good.
She's really good. I hope she gets in touch.
That's a Kimia solo.
Tried to email her too.
Oh, you didn't get. Oh, you tried Kimia?
Yeah. Well, I tried her management company. You know,
yeah.
I don't think management companies forward things on. Truly.
No, it's probably true. And yeah, maybe she hadn't listened to the podcast. If she had, she would have definitely replied because this is so. Yeah.
Yeah.
But she probably gets a lot of people wanting to talk about Twee, and she's like,
she's very much the first lady of Twee,
and she wouldn't. She probably doesn't want to be. Because none of us want to be Twee.
You seem fine with this.
I've come to terms with it. I've found a place to be comfortable with it. But I don't think any of us used to self-describe as sweet. Now I'm just like, well, yeah. I'm just glad to get any attention. If someone's talking about us, that's amazing.
It's been lovely giving you this attention today.
Thanks so much for all the attention.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks so much for having me.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. The podcast was produced and edited by me, with mix and music by Harry Harris and artwork by Gavin Day. If you'd like to email me about the pod, you can do so on sentimentalpod@gmail.com or get in touch with me directly on Twitter or Instagram @Zaraline.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.